What's up, guys? Welcome to this episode of Unemployable. Today, we are joined by an incredible guest. Eric V. Stacks joins us from Northern California. He is a weed farmer by trade and profession. One could say a commodity producer who became a Bitcoiner in 2017. This is a very deep, very interesting, very passionate discussion around why Bitcoin is something every single one of you need to learn about and embrace. Especially if you've been feeling it, that you're working harder for less, that things are getting tougher out there in the world, and you know something's wrong, but you don't really know what it is or why it is or how it is, much less what to do about it. This podcast will really get you thinking and hopefully acting in a whole new way. If you like the content, make sure you like, subscribe, drop a comment. Let us know. Do you want more guests like Eric on there? Let us know what you think of Eric. I'm sure he's going to read the comments as well at some point. So with that said, thanks for watching. Let's get straight into it. All right, guys, welcome to this episode of Unemployable. We are joined today by Eric V. Stacks, who's joining us from Northern California. As you might be able to see in the background there, Eric is, or has been, I'm not sure, you still are, a weed farmer, right?
Yeah, my career is coming to an end here in the cannabis business, but I figured I'd set up here for one last podcast. Yes. 16 years of growing cannabis professionally.
That's amazing. So that backdrop is real. That's awesome. I love it.
It is real. Yes.
Eric, I've listened to you on a few pods and you've got, there's so many angles we could take this interview, but you know, you're spending more and more time now, much like I am, sort of advocating for Bitcoin and being an evangelist for Bitcoin. Tell us, how did a weed farmer from Northern California find his way to Bitcoin? What drew you to it? And what, let's start talking about what's kept you going with Bitcoin and growing with Bitcoin.
Wow, that's kind of a large question, but I'll distill this down to the basics for you here. So I moved to Northern California in 2009. I grew up in Southern California. A friend of mine went to Humboldt State University, got involved with some of the cannabis farmers here and invited me to Northern California to trim some cannabis on a medical marijuana farm. And so as soon as I got here, I knew immediately what I was going to commit at least a portion of my life to. So I got here in 2009. I never left. I worked for an individual for 2 years under the medical marijuana laws in the state of California. It was Proposition 215, allowed you to produce cannabis and sell it with in a collective to qualified patient members. I saved up some money and I started my own little grow operation in a garage of a house. And then in 2015, I found myself in Southern Humboldt in Garberville on a large 40-acre parcel, setting up a grow in a partnership with some landowners. And then about a year later, Jerry Brown, the governor of the state of California, signed into effect MRSA, which was the Medical Marijuana Safety Regulations Act, which that bill effectively put into effect a framework for legalization for adult use in the state of California. And what that bill did is it said that the counties needed to permit any cannabis activity. And then ultimately, once the counties permitted the activity, the state would then license that those businesses. So I scrapped together every dollar I could possibly get my hands on, and I bought a piece of property in consultation with Humboldt County Planning Department. And as soon as I closed escrow on that parcel, it was 10 acres with a house and 7 acres adjacent land that I was going to ultimately turn into a cannabis farm. And upon closing escrow, I then like had this huge economic incentive for me and my life for the first time to understand the economic system that we are operating in, the boom bust cycles. I had all my money tied up in this real estate and I wanted to understand what was causing, you know, real estate prices to go up or go down or whatever. When the great financial crisis happened in 2009, I was like 22 years old. I was selling cars for a Toyota store. So I wasn't in a position in my life to really look deeply at what was taking place, but I knew the basics. So there I am. It's like 2017, the beginning of the year, and I'm just devouring YouTube content about, you know, Federal Reserve, Creature from Jekyll Island, Keynesian economics. And then I, you know, discovered Austrian economic theory, hard money. And within 9 months of going down that rabbit hole, in December of 2017, I discovered Bitcoin. And as a commodity producer, watching the value of the product that I had been producing go down simply as a result of supply satiating demand, I was really well primed to understand the magnitude of a monetary instrument that was finite in supply. So the discovery of Bitcoin really blew my mind. I knew that a money essentially has infinite demand on it because money is a call option on any good or service that the marketplace can produce. So if you compare that with true scarcity, now you have the apex monetary instrument of our civilization. So I became quite passionate about Bitcoin, and actually the discovery of Bitcoin helped me to see a little bit more clearly the position that I was in as a cannabis producer. And so this very vindicating moment for me in my life, 2018, so I just discovered Bitcoin, and then a month later I get a license from the state of California for my cannabis business, which was like a dream come true moment. But after going down the economic rabbit hole for the, you know, 9 months before that, I realized I had an existential crisis and that the value of the product was going to continue to decrease, all while my cost of living and operating was going to increase. So I decided to sell the farm and pivot my business strategy to farm management and consulting services. And I'm actually pretty glad that I did, because the next, you know, handful of years, the value of the product did exactly what I thought. It continued to go down while my operating costs continued to go up. And so without adopting a Bitcoin treasury strategy, or without becoming balance sheet focused, I would have had real problems in my business. I watched a lot of people in the area through the legal process continue to expand and reinvest all their earnings into their cannabis businesses, and the land and the businesses, the value is directly related to the value of the commodity that's being produced on them. So, you know, I'm seeing a lot of people within the area, especially now that we fast forward the clock a little bit more, 90% of the farms in Humboldt County have gone out of business over the last 5 years. And that's not because there's a lot of rhetoric within the community about how the state messed it up and there's too many regulations. Like, that's all real. But on the I think the thing that's more important to focus on is that your P&L in any business at any time is always going to be in danger. If you have a strong P&L, that's an opportunity. That's a beacon of opportunity to other entrepreneurs and capital to move into that sector of the marketplace and satiate that demand with supply, which is dilutive of the existing businesses. So, basically, like, you know, I plowed into Bitcoin. Over the years, I've sold everything that I could possibly sell, put it all into Bitcoin. I live in a rental. I've been doing consulting services for farms like the one that I'm at. And I've become quite passionate about Bitcoin as a result. My thesis, you know, was pretty spot on when I first discovered Bitcoin and had like all these epiphanies. It's like a series of epiphanies as you travel down the rabbit hole. And I've become quite passionate about it. So that's a long answer, but try to be comprehensive there.
No, look, that's a great answer. And I think that you're not, the situation you described is not exclusive to the weed business. It's kind of all businesses, especially for a lot of our listeners in Australia and New Zealand, where we already are in a small market to start with. Whenever we see a successful business, more people, you know, go into that business, and you've got sort of competition factors which are driving costs down, but you've also got technology factors, like Jeff Booth says, you know, that technology should be deflationary. If you think inflation's bad, if you really understood what it would be without technology making things cheaper on the underlying, it would be quite frightening. But I think a lot of business owners kind of feel that way. They're kind of like, hang on a minute, I'm working harder. The goalposts just seem to be getting further and further away, no matter how hard it is. And Bitcoin kind of fixes that. I'd love to hear from a farmer's point of view what you think, like, when you said you used a lot of great terms in there, hard money. Like, why should people care about hard money, hardworking people in our communities? Why should that? What is hard money in your description? And why do they need to understand it and care about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So when I think of hard money, I think of a monetary instrument that's hard to produce more of. And for the last 5,000 plus years or whatever, we've used gold because it's the hardest to produce more of. that it's portable, it's fungible, it's divisible, it's durable, and then, of course, it's scarce. So those five properties of money, those five properties, gold best adhered to those five properties out of anything else that we had. But because gold is physical, it lacked in its portability. So you needed to build a layered system on top of it, a derivative system. And I think hard money is really important because, actually, speaking of Jeff Booth, one of the things that he says that I really love so much is where you have abundance in money, where the money is very abundant, you create scarcity in everything else. And I think that that's rather intuitive, especially if you look at the economy here in the United States. People go into the marketplace, they earn a surplus, they take their surplus, and then they store it in equities in companies, or they store it in real estate or in commodities like gold or treasuries, T-bills, whatever. They're moving out. They're effectively moving out of the money and into another monetary instrument that is harder than the money is. And actually, that it incentivizes you to even short the money, to take out debt. I'm going to take out some debt, some leverage, and I'm going to short the dollar, and I'm going to go long the real estate. Well, what that's doing is that's monetizing things like housing that other people need to live in, you know. And it's even more extreme in places like Venezuela, where somebody gets a paycheck and 2 weeks later, they know that the groceries that they need to buy are going to be more expensive than they are as soon as they get the paycheck. So they get out of the money as soon as possible. Now, where you have a scarcity in money, you create abundance in everything else. Where the money is the hardest thing in the marketplace, where it's appreciating at the fastest rate because it's the hardest to produce more of, the incentive is then to hold the money and not hold any of these other monetary instruments, other assets that have been monetized. So I believe that over time, now that we have the hardest money ever, the incentive to serve one's self-interest is simply to hoard that. You want as much of that as you could possibly get. It's like Jack Mallers says, money is your time and energy in an abstracted form. So everyone will always want more of that. Like, there's not infinite demand for cars or for cannabis facilities or for black hats or whatever it is, but there is infinite demand for money. And so people will always want to hoard as much money as they can. And what's another thing that's really special about Bitcoin is it's invisible, right? So it's invisible. It has no intrinsic value, as what some people would say. And I think when people are referring to intrinsic value, like when the Peter Schiffs of the world are like, hey, Bitcoin has no intrinsic value, I think what they mean is it has no industrial use. It's a purely monetary technology. And because it's invisible, you can hoard it, and the hoarding of it is ethical. That, and you're actually pulling monetary units out of that network, strengthening the value of the ones trading within the economy. So hard money is very important. And, you know, in my case, I've been experiencing wage deflation in nominal terms, not in real terms, where like I'm actually making money, less currency every year in dollar terms while my cost of operating is going up. As an example, 10 years ago, a bulk wholesale pound of cannabis, premier cannabis, was like $3,000, let's say. Now that same pound, honestly, a better pound, is like $500 to $800. But within that last 10 years, my cost of operating, my cost of goods sold, is probably doubled, if not tripled. So I'm making, what is that, like 1/6 to, I don't know, 1/18 per unit produced.
Yeah.
So that really helped me to realize, like, when the Sailor series came out in 2021 and then the Booth series on Robert Breedlove's show came out after that, those two conversations really helped me understand and put terminology to things that I was actually witnessing happen in my life. Intuitively, I knew these things were happening. It's a deflationary world. Commodities are a challenge to produce. You have to either build a regulatory moat to protect your sector in the marketplace to essentially stifle the supply. We have the natural state of a free market is deflation. So we have these deflationary forces in our world. It's real. It's easy to see when you actually stop and think about it. But you pair that with the Keynesian economic model, and it's bifurcating our society. It's shredding our reality. It's causing some state of like psychosis. People are confused. They don't know what's happening. The The governmental apparatus that's debasing the currency is then incentivized to lie about what's happening. You got CPI, these manipulated metrics. You got all this gaslighting. So it causes an immense state of confusion. And the productivity within the marketplace is being siphoned out of the marketplace and being reallocated to different business endeavors, I suppose you could say, by the central authorities, the central bank, the government, et cetera. And so these are real problems. And now we have this hard money that's digital, that's scalable, it's hypermobile, it's inviolable. And that, and this new discovery, this technology seems to be the thing that the world is starting to reorganize itself around. And that's a really big deal, monumentally big deal.
Yeah. And you covered so many things there. And I think you probably trod on a few landmines for Australians, particularly young Australians. We're leading into an election as we're doing this interview in, April? We're in April or May 25.
Yep.
We're leading into an election in Australia, and one of the hottest electoral issues is housing affordability. And when people say Bitcoin's worthless, Bitcoin doesn't do anything, I'm like, oh, except touch just about every real world problem that is causing real pain for people, like housing affordability. You said there, I want to double click on that because I want the Aussie audience to not miss what you said. You said that because Australians are the world champion at going short on the dollar and long on real estate. Mm-hmm. Maybe just explain that little piece a little bit more for the listeners to understand. When you said that people, this has caused homes, which people need to live in, to become an investment, have become a place where people are storing cash because they believe the house is a better store of value than cash, to the point where they're prepared to go into debt to borrow the cash. Maybe you could just double click on that and explain to people, because I know that's going to touch a nerve with our audience.
Yes. So money needs to do two things. It needs to send value through space and time. And when the currency is being diluted by increasing the supply, or the supply is increasing, which is diluting the current holders, it's hurting that currency or that monetary instrument's ability to project its value forward in time. In the United States, I think generally we're like 9-10% or something for the last, I don't know, many couple decades or whatever, is the rate of increase in supply of the dollars that are in existence, right? So M2 is increasing. So if you're being diluted at 10% a year, you're incentivized, if you're trying to project your economic energy into the future, to put that economic energy into another investable asset that has a lower dilution rate. And so if you can take out debt, like in the form, like we see this in the States and like you're mentioning in Australia, you can effectively short one asset that's losing its value really fast and go long an asset that's losing its value slower. And that causes a real problem, because what ends up happening is housing has utility value. People need to live in a home. You need a roof over your head. But what's happened is it also has this monetary premium that's been put on it, because people are effectively hoarding houses to project their economic energy forward in time. And that's causing a housing shortage. That's a big problem. And, one of the things that I will add to this idea that I think most people are unaware of is if you take a house that's appreciating at 9% a year on average, and the currency is increasing in supply by 9% a year on average, then you're actually treading water by holding that asset. Now let's add in the fact that you're going to have real estate tax. Most jurisdictions are going to be like an average of 1%. Then you're going to have your average annual maintenance cost at 1%. So if you have paid for real estate that you're using as an investment, you have that's no mortgage, paid for real estate, you have effectively a 2% carrying cost. You could think of that 2% carrying cost. It's the same thing with gold, actually. Gold, you own gold, you have a 2% dilution rate because the supply is increasing by 2% every year. So if you are trying to project your economic energy into the future and you have a 2% dilution or a 2% ownership carrying cost, which is going to be dilution, That equates to a 35-year half-life. So you're losing you're losing half the value over 35 years. So it's not actually a really good store of value. It's better than the currency. And another thing that's taking place with houses, and I saw a chart of the S&P index. I think it was on Swan Bitcoin like a year ago. So they show the chart in nominal dollar terms, and it's a hockey stick up to the right. Then they adjust for M2. They complete the algebraic equation so you could actually see the real value. And what's happening is it's going down by 0.5% or by a percent over the last 100 years. The same thing is happening with housing, depending on the jurisdiction that you're in. Some places like Miami beachfront property might be even over that last 100 years. Now you subtract your ownership cost, your taxes or whatever. You're not effectively sending all of that economic energy into the future. And with Bitcoin, once we hit 21 million coins, and even today with the current mining reward, it's the hardest asset on planet Earth as far as stock to flow goes. So if you're trying to project your capital, your economic energy into the future, you want an asset that's being diluted at the slowest rate possible. And ultimately, you want no dilution and you want no ownership costs and you want no taxes. So I'm moving out of Northern California. If I had a real estate portfolio and I wasn't interested in being a landlord, a service provider, which is another thing that happens. People invest in real estate and then this real estate has to cash flow. I got to do Airbnb or I got to get a tenant to lease this thing. Well, now just to project your economic energy into the future, you're forced to become a service provider. So if I didn't want to do that, I'd have to liquidate my real estate and then go buy real estate in a new jurisdiction somewhere. There's a lot of friction in that. It's like 6% commission I got to pay to the real estate agents. Let's say you got $1 million in real estate, you're going to pay $60,000 to just sell that. So it's not a very liquid asset and it's not very effectively projecting your energy into the future. You know, I tell people sometimes when we get onto, you know, this line of conversation, that what's happening with your car is the same thing that's happening with your house. You're measuring the value of the car and the house in a currency. Now, the value of the currency is decreasing so fast that it creates the optical illusion that the house is going up in value, but it's not being debased fast enough so that it makes the value of the car go up in nominal terms, but they're actually both going down in real terms. So a lot of people are unaware of that. They think, hey, my portfolio of stocks or real estate or whatever it's comprised of is increasing in value, but it's only increasing in value in dollar terms. And so without adjusting for the amount of dollars within the system, you can't accurately see whether you're getting wealthier or not. That's a long answer there, but yes.
Yeah, well, the term optical illusion is very, very powerful. I haven't heard somebody describe it like that. But, you know, I helped my son buy a house just pre-COVID. I helped his 22 at the time. We got him into his first home, and that home doubled in value through COVID. But and it's easy to look at it and go, oh, wow, you know, you just got richer. And I'm like, not really, because if you sell that house, you got to pay all these exit costs. You'll probably be slightly behind to get into any other property of similar value, but you've had all these holding costs in the meantime. So you mm-hmm. feel like you've gotten richer, but the quality of your life hasn't changed at all. It's not like you could sell that house and in the same area buy a better house. You're just going to go sideways, and that's with it doubling, and then you got to take the cost off, which is the leakage, which creates the optical illusion. It's very, very interesting when you really start to sit and think, and for a lot of listeners out there, what Eric's describing, I say it in every pod that we have with Bitcoin, it's like in the Matrix where there's a splinter in your mind, there's something wrong, you don't know what it is, but there's just something you don't write. And then Morpheus says, you want the blue pill or the red pill, and we'll figure this stuff out. And that's why we call it orange pilling in Bitcoin, because once you start to tumble down this rabbit hole, and I know many of you listening to Eric are already saying to yourself, I'm going to have to listen to that back. Because I feel like he's saying the right thing and it's true, but I'm going to have to hear that twice. And you should go back and have discussions until you understand what Eric just said, because he dropped some serious serious knowledge there that's been earned over many, many years now, since 2017 to today. So, you know, it is, Eric, you know, a technology that very much impacts people. And when people start in their real life, you know, a lot of people are still stuck with Bitcoin. And I've heard you say this as well, of how do I make money out of Bitcoin? And by having that question, they're missing what Bitcoin is. Did you want to speak to that quickly about the problem with looking at the Bitcoin price and asking how you're going to make money out of it rather than really saying what the technology does?
Yeah, well, I think that Bitcoin is like it's part of a paradigm shift. It's like a state change, like the fabric of our reality in some sense. And not to go too deep or be too metaphysical, but like we literally changed a lot of things about how our reality works in 2009. I actually talk about the pre-2009 era, all of known history to 2009 is the BB world before Bitcoin. Now we're in the AB world after Bitcoin. And what Satoshi did is he effectively merged the physical world with the digital world. You now have matter in cyberspace. You can send information through cyberspace as a bearer instrument. So what he did was is he solved the double spend problem. For all of history, if I gave you any piece of information, let's say I say, hey, go down to the river, there's a fishing hole there. That's a data packet. I give you this piece of information. You can go and procure food. You have that information, but I also have that information. So that's the double spend problem. You can't use information as money unless you can make it so that you can't double spend that information, that data packet. And that's what Bitcoin did. He solved the double spend problem. So you can send information, I can send you coins digitally through the internet. It's information. It leaves my possession. Goes into your possession. I forgot. I lost my train of thought there. What was the question there? Reiterate the
No,
question
I
for
was
me.
just explaining, you know, I was just asking you to explain I think I was asking you to explain the significance of this technology in people's lives. I kind of lost the question as well. I was just
No,
so interrupted.
that's okay. That helps me out.
Solves the double spend problem. And in 2009, Satoshi, you know, enabled people to send value through time and space. Digitally, which has never existed before without an intermediary in the middle keeping the ledger.
And another thing that he did though is he discover it's the discovery of scarcity. Like outside of Bitcoin, the only thing on planet Earth that's like truly, you know, scarce would be square mileage, I suppose you could say. But we have plenty of unused land that we can continue to develop and develop. So every time, like, for example, I'm moving to Florida. When Dubai started to build, and they're building luxury real estate, they got this new beautiful place that you can go live and do business in. That's dilutive of beachfront real estate in Miami or in Malibu or in Sydney or whatever, right? And so the discovery of scarcity is a really big thing because you have this monetary instrument that you're not going to be diluted in. So the incentive then is if you're trying to serve your self-interest and project your economic energy into the future, you want the most scarce thing. And because you have this thing that's informational, it's essentially invisible and it's scarce, the incentive to get the most is to get the Bitcoin. And what that means is that over time, people are going to be holding on to less physical things like housing in order to project their economic energy into the future. So the significance of a hard monetary instrument that's digital just can't be overstated. As an example, I've been in Humboldt County for, I don't know, whatever it is, 16 years. I bought a piece of property, I turned it into a cannabis farm, I sold it. When I sold that land, if I didn't have the ability to buy Bitcoin, then the most logical thing to do would have been to buy some equities and to buy some real estate, maybe a couple rental properties, right? Well, the fact that I didn't do that means that there's less people bidding for the existing housing here in Humboldt County. There's less upward price pressure on the houses, making it, even though it might be infinitesimal, making it more affordable for the people who do want a house. Because if I'm not holding on to houses, a bunch of houses, and other people are starting to figure this out as well, there's effectively reducing the demand on houses relative to the existing supply. So one of the things that I say, and this is kind of you know, I had to go through this myself a little bit, and I've heard a lot of conversation within the Bitcoin community about how they're concerned for people who don't have Bitcoin, the no coiners, you could say. Oh, you guys are going to miss out. Well, you're going to miss out on the great demonetization. You got $900 trillion worth of assets. You could say $450 trillion, and these are just rough estimates that I've heard. I don't know if they're accurate or not, but you get the point. $450 trillion of that $900 trillion worth of stuff on planet Earth is store of value. It's capital preservation. So we've effectively monetized all of these other assets because the currency is shitty. Where you have abundance of money, you create scarcity and everything else. Because the currency is being diluted at such a fast rate, rational market participants are moving out of the currency and into anything else that they can to preserve their economic energy or project their capital into the future. And so as that changes, as people realize Bitcoin is a better asset to store their value in, that economic energy, that capital tied up in this $900 trillion worth of stuff is going to over time move into the Bitcoin network, which is making things like housing more affordable for the people who want them. And one of the things that I find very, very interesting is, like, you know, you're talking about in Australia, there's the, you know, a lot of conversation around affordable housing. Same thing here in the States, London, Europe. Like, it's a real problem because we've monetized housing, because wealthy people, and because of the system with fractional reserve banking, has to continue to prop asset prices up. It has to inject liquidity into the marketplace. It has to continue to debase. So it has to debase against something in the form of debt, right? So housing is the perfect thing, or has been the perfect thing, to lend dollars into existence as debt against, which creates this feedback loop. It means that the people who own 10 houses at a net worth of 10, or, you know, at a gross value of $5 million, for example, currency is being debased to 10% a year. Year one, you go from $5 to $5.5 million worth of real estate. Now you're incentivized to go and borrow that $500,000 and go buy another piece of property, right? So it creates this feedback loop, which is bifurcating our society. It's creating a have not have yachts world, which is a real problem. And as a result, then people get up in arms and they're like, oh no, we can't do this. Let's increase taxes. Let's effectively confiscate the property of the productive market actors who are producing a surplus. It's this communistic force, this socialistic force, this centralized entity that's debasing the currency, is creating this bifurcation in our society. And then the people who are suffering from that are voting for more communistic, socialistic things. Like, let's just tax the rich. Let's confiscate their property, which is not going to help the problem, which is further exacerbates the problem. The real problem is the money printing. And so
it's broken. We're broken money.
Yes.
And that's what I keep trying to say to people, is we have broken money. And I made the mistake on social media recently of saying, when you see your shopping cart prices going through the roof, don't be angry at, in Australia, Coles and Woolworths that pretty much control most of the supermarkets.
Yeah.
Be angry at central bank. And it's a line out of Bitcoin Standard with SafeSend. But and people just savage me because they don't understand that the actual problem is broken money.
Yeah. You know,
and there's all this hatred of the rich, eat the rich, burn the rich.
Totally.
And I understand the anger, especially in young people. I understand the anger, but the solution isn't, when you look at what's incentivized, humans are going to act in accordance with incentives, which in Australia, the banks make billions out of mortgages. The governments make billions out of stamp duty and fees. There is so much economic incentive to support the system as it is, but we're seeing change afoot. We're seeing, really irate, angry people who are being left behind, and they're now feeling it for the first time, which this gap, even the beneficiaries of this are speaking up, saying, look, I'm a beneficiary of the wealth that was created, and it's not right. Because we've just decimated the middle class in Australia, and you guys in America are a bit ahead of us on that. You know, you just absolutely decimated. Have-nots and have-yots is a great term. Very, very interesting. And this is, guys, why I keep bringing people like Eric on, to try and raise the alarm through a different voice and a different angle. So, you know, Eric, you know, when you did sell your farm, and this will be blow people's minds, but I suspect you put most, if not all of it, into Bitcoin. Did you diversify at all, or are you a Bitcoin maxi?
This was in late 2018. And for that, so I discovered Bitcoin in 2017 in December. And then for the next year, it took me about a year to sell my property. I actually had a lot of legal issues around the property. I was near a, I don't know, a little short story here is the county planning department put together their land use ordinance with public comment. It was a very, long ongoing process. When the ordinance passed, now there was a rule set that you could adhere to. You could go and find land if it had, you know, met the setbacks. It didn't have endangered species, any of these things. You had to get biological studies, all these things. So I bought my property based upon the legal framework that was put into place. And the neighboring city and a few neighboring parcels got really upset about my property. So there was all these threats of lawsuits. There was like a lot of drama around it. And so the planning department issued a new land use ordinance. So for about 6-9 months there, my property was tied up in limbo where the fate of the license was to be determined. So I was very focused all of 2018 as of basically getting out of the position that I was in. I was like, I just got to get out of this property. It was like I was stuck on a roller coaster and couldn't get off. Or maybe like it's like I was playing blackjack and I kept winning, but all my winnings just went all back in on the table. It was a very stressful time for me in my life. And so I didn't have the time and energy to go deep down the rabbit hole until I was free of that situation. And so I put about half of what I got into Bitcoin, and then I bought some gold and some silver, and I've been in a cash-based business. So I've had banking impedance, even though I've been lawful within the state of California, and I paid taxes. All of that has been above board. I still had issues with the bank. I couldn't just go put large sums of money, cash into the bank very easily. So over the next handful of years is when I sold down my gold and silver and put the rest into Bitcoin. Actually, when the Sailor series hit, which I think was like the beginning of 2021, I panic sold everything that I possibly could that wasn't Bitcoin and put it, sweating fucking bullets, man. Like, oh my gosh, I got to get rid of all this stuff. Like, this is the thing. You know, before that, I kind of had this idea that this is going to take over the world or it's going to get shut down. And I'm not a cryptographer. I'm not a computer scientist. I'm not a software engineer. I'm just a fucking dude who's been growing cannabis, just a little small entrepreneur. So I didn't understand that it was indestructible. And once I came to that conclusion in 2021 is when I took on a 100% Bitcoin position and actually changed my strategy. I remember going to my wife. She was pregnant at the time. I was sitting in the sauna like almost every day. It was kind of like a little downtime for me. Listened to the Sailor series, was just devouring Bitcoin content on YouTube. And I went into the house one day and I was like, look, we're planning on moving someday and we want to buy a house somewhere. And we've had all this pressure to try to figure out where we're going to buy a house. It's a big commitment. You know, like we have a certain quality of things that we would like to manifest for ourselves in our life. It's like, but why do we want a house? So we could be safe, so we could be secure, so we could like raise our family and whatever. I was like, so how about this though? How about we rent the house? Especially because we have all this uncertainty. We just came out of COVID. There's all these, I don't know, you got Ukraine and all these things happening. And so it's like, so there's uncertainty in the world. We want to hedge ourselves against that uncertainty. I was like, I actually think we're better off if we rent the house and we hold the Bitcoin. It's hypermobile. We could take it anywhere we want in the world. If we find ourselves in a jurisdiction that becomes less friendly to Bitcoin, then we just go and we take our Bitcoin. If we need to move somewhere, then we just simply write a 30-day notice and we say, hey, we're out. And I actually think, too, that for optionality, for security, and for wealth accruement, you do better by holding an asset that's got a CAGR of 45-55% a year. Why would I take 50K, 100K, 200K, whatever it is, out of Bitcoin and put it into real estate? I'm actually going to get wealthier by keeping that in Bitcoin and renting the house. And I have a buddy who is like kind of broken down and done some spreadsheets on this. And he's like, yeah, I actually think you're right. You know, it's like over time, even if you adjust for the fact that like you're going to have a fixed mortgage, you still have more optionality by holding the Bitcoin and renting the real estate. And so, yeah,
I just, you're preaching to the choir. I just sold all my real estate, move to a tax-friendly environment and have complete optionality. And I did it because I realized at age 51 that, you know, I started down the entrepreneurial journey at age 19 to be free. That was my end goal. It wasn't about Porsches or fancy houses and all that stuff. I've earned all those things over the years. But at the end of the day, really what's really made me happiest is optionality. It's freedom. It's knowing that I can travel in self-custody and there is no intermediary between me and, you know, my Bitcoin stack and so on. But I totally agree with you. But these are things that people have to sit down with a pen and a paper and a calculator. And the other thing that I hear a lot, you know, people saying, you know, Bitcoin's so risky. And I'm like, let me tell you what's not risky. Your dollar is going to zero. That's not an opinion. That's not even an opinion about the future. It's a comment about the past. Just go to ChatGPT and put in, if inflation's 4%, what is my money worth in 30 years? It is not maybe going to zero. It is going to zero. And then you look back at the history of Bitcoin and say, well, if what is the CAGR, or compound annual growth rate, of Bitcoin? Even if you don't take it back to 2009, if you just take it back, you know, 6-7 years, you know, in those really massive high growth times, what's the CAGR? Like, it's right there. It's actually historic. It's not an opinion about the future. The difference is time preference. And Bitcoin just simply have a different time preference. They have the ability to zoom out a little bit and be patient and understand volatility, but it's volatility to the upside. So, guys, all of you listening, if you haven't read the Bitcoin Standard, please read it. If you haven't read the Tao of Bitcoin, I don't know if you've read that book, Eric, you'll love it if you haven't, but the Tao
of Bitcoin. I have not, actually.
Yeah, it's an absolute, you particularly will love it, the Tao of Bitcoin. Have a listen to these books and start getting yourself educated. What I'd like to talk about, Eric, is the importance, because you talked about incentives and I've talked about incentives, and we must understand that we live within a world largely where the rules are made by human beings, and human beings operate on incentives, and we suck at our ability to not access money printers, which, you know, democracies are great, you know, ways to run countries, but probably better than communism. But I can't remember who said it, but it's the best of a bunch of bad choices. But effectively with places where we get to elect our governments, we essentially put our voters next to the money printer, because our politicians just say, hey, listen, if you vote me in, I'll give you all this stuff, which I'm just going to print the money to fulfill, right? So maybe you could just talk about the difference for the listeners and the absolute significance and why Bitcoin sits separate to and is not anything like the crypto space, right? Because we don't have anybody, like right now as we sit here in the crypto press, we've got, you know, Vitalik talking about changes that he's going to be making to Ethereum. Why is Bitcoin different to the centralized cryptocurrencies that have human beings that are vulnerable to greed, vulnerable to the wishes of other people, and why Bitcoin's different to that, why it can't be changed, and the importance of that not being changeable at the whim of one person or a small group of people?
Yes. Okay. So that's a very large question, and I'll try to pack all my thoughts into one.
Why does it matter?
Piece of thought process. So I think a lot about how we got into the situation that we find ourselves in the world today in 2025. And what I think about is I actually refer to this as the game theoretic fuckedness. And the game theoretic fuckedness is the reality that we were limited to the physicality of gold. That was the best. A yellow shiny rock was the best monetary technology that we had to use to organize ourselves economically around in order to build the civilization that we live in today. And the physicality of gold required that it sits in the hands of a custodian. It's because it's physical, it centralizes. You want to give the gold to a custodian so you could travel from London to Italy and buy a villa. And you're going to take certificates that the custodian issues, and you're going to trade those in the marketplace, and they're going to be as good as gold. And that way you don't have to take the gold. Because the gold's physical, the incentive is, if you want the gold that someone else has, if you're a sociopath, you just kill them and you take it, right? And so there's an incentive to violence in anything that's physical. Now, there's a corruption, there's an element of corruption that comes into play. If you're a gold custodian who can issue more certificates than you have gold on reserve, then you have an advantage in the marketplace. And if you could grease the wheels of a king or some political regime to create things like bank holidays, you could effectively prevent yourself from being exposed or from that dishonesty being exposed, right? And so that's essentially the runaway train that we have today, where the dishonest market participant has had the advantage because they've been able to get away with the corruption, and our ability to expose that corruption has been rather low. And now that we have Bitcoin, which is effectively, it's a protocol. It's a protocol stack built on top of the internet. And it's effectively two things. It's the nodes. So it's a decentralized ledger. And those, that ledger, a copy of that ledger is on like 10 to 60,000 computers spread all over the world. And I've heard varying numbers about how many nodes there are. Then you have the miners who are using an enormous amount of electricity to guess a number that the algorithm spits out. If the whatever miner guesses that number has the privilege of getting paid the transaction fees to move coins around on that ledger, and they get the mining reward, which is the new issuance of Bitcoin. Because it's truly decentralized, it's the only cryptocurrency that's truly decentralized. Nobody can change the rules. It doesn't matter how many coins you have, how much electricity you can produce. You can produce a bunch of electricity. If you try to mine a false block, the amount of electricity that is required for a node to deny that block is extremely low. So what that does is it, go ahead, you have a question?
I was going to say, and the incentive's not there, because if you go ahead and double spend and corrupt it, what's Bitcoin worth then? You've just
totally
poisoned the cake you stole. You're not going to eat
and
it.
The thing, yeah, so the node operators, let's say there's a Bitcoin improvement proposal, a BIP, to double the supply. Like CNBC, Jamie Dimon gets on CNBC and that motherfucker says, hey, maybe Satoshi could come back in 100 years and just double the supply. Well, I think that that is a total lie. I think he can pronounce Satoshi's name. This guy's famous for waking up and reading a couple hours every morning. He's the CEO of the largest banking establishment in the world. So I think that that was a little bit of FUD to confuse the everyday individual. But the node operators are in control of the monetary policy. So why would a node operator download an improvement to double the supply of Bitcoin that would dilute themselves? It goes against their self-interest. If you had the ability to mine a false block, I don't know what the cost is today. It's a couple $100,000 worth of electricity. Why would you spend a couple $100,000 worth of electricity to attempt to create a fraudulent transaction when it takes a node in someone's house or garage, 5 cents, 2 cents, a penny's worth of electricity to deny that block? So you're actually incentivized to mine the Bitcoin, not try to attack the network. And so that's kind of the incentive vortex within like the basic framework of the Bitcoin network. Like, I'm not going to dilute myself, so I'm not going to vote, or I'm not going to download an update to double the supply. If I'm a miner, I'm not going to attempt to amass all that energy to try to create a fraudulent transaction or double spend or whatever, because I actually, my likelihood of getting away with that is extremely low. And if I had that much electricity, I might as well just mine the Bitcoin. So I might as well get in line with the monetary policy there, and I should get rewarded from it. And then let's fast forward the clock. If we end up on a Bitcoin standard and Bitcoin becomes the world's capital asset, which I think we're in the midst of that happening, then you have Lightning providers, which is a layer two, which is in some sense you could think of like a gold custodian. You're going to send your Bitcoin to a Lightning provider. They're going to take the Bitcoin, which is going to be your main chain Bitcoin, and then you're going to use their ledger and you're going to trade sats or Bitcoin on their ledger faster and for lower fees. And then if you ever want to take that Bitcoin back into possession, you're going to go ahead and just take it out of that bank or that Lightning provider. You're going to put it back into your own custody on the main chain. So if you have a Lightning provider, or this is actually the ETF, same thing. So if the ETFs, let's say BlackRock, the market gets concerned that BlackRock has sold more claims to Bitcoin than they have Bitcoin on reserve. Well, that gives the opportunity for Fidelity or for any other ETF issuer to just show proof of reserves. And then anybody with a running a node can verify, or with just an iPhone or a laptop, you can pull that address from a and put it into a Block Explorer, and you can see that they have those coins. So that means that the dishonest market participant, the dishonest custodian, bank, whatever it is, will be exposed for that dishonesty much easier than it was to have a bank run when we're using a gold standard. And so that's going to actually reward the honest market participants and punish the dishonest ones, which is a complete inverse of what we've had in basically the all of known time, because you've had everything centralized because of the physicality of the monetary instrument that we were using. Another thing that's quite interesting about Bitcoin is because it's this non-sovereign, decentralized monetary protocol, no government. Like, I think about the first debate. It was kind of a debate, but it was a conversation with George Gammon and Jeff Booth. Jeff Booth, who's been thinking about this for a long time, is talking to George Gammon, and he's explaining this kind of some of the stuff we're talking about now. And George Gammon keeps coming back to him and saying, well, hey, there's going to be another COVID, and then the government will just print more dollars. They'll print more dollars against the Bitcoin. They'll figure out how to dilute the Bitcoin. And the conversation was like, they'll corrupt it. And Jeff Booth's like, how? And Gammon's like, they'll corrupt it. And Booth is like, but how? And they've since then had more conversations. And Gammon seems to understand that that main chain, that 21 million units, is effectively, you could say, Bitcoiners can talk in certainties, but I just want to preface this. It's all probabilities. It is the least probable thing in the marketplace that the Bitcoin supply increases, changes, or that the monetary protocol gets corrupted. And so because you have that restriction that, on the monetary policy, that the individuals, you could say the plebs or the peasants or the people, anybody running a node is the effectively, it's like actually truly democratic in that sense too, because the node operators are going to vote to any changes to the protocol, and they're not going to vote against their self-interest. And so because the government...
It's the What's node that? Operators that have the vote. It's not how it much Bitcoin you own. It's the
And it's not operators. The miners either. It's not the miners, and it's not the holders. Yeah.
People need to know that, because when they think about BlackRock and well, how many nodes do they operate, not how much do they own or control. It's how much they operate. What is BlackRock's incentive? Like, why are they there? Well, because they're scraping fees off huge tranches of money. Like, I think about $100 billion of Bitcoin, the ETFs, at half a percent. There's 500 million. What is that? 500 million a year in fees by running the ETF.
A lot. Yes.
So they're fine. Yeah. Taking half a billion in fees just off the ETF management. So very interesting. Yeah.
Well, and BlackRock's incentivized to be honest, because if they're dishonest, they'll go out of business, which is the inverse of
$500 million of fee income.
Totally.
Right? Like, why would they want to fuck with Bitcoin when they're making, it's the most successful ETF in the history of the world? Why would they want to fuck with that?
Right? Totally. Well, and it's too risky to be dishonest. It's not that much risk to be dishonest with your gold ETF, because what are you going to do? Are a bunch of peasants just going to band together with pitchforks and fucking storm some warehouse somewhere? Show us the gold. You couldn't even verify if it was real or not. It could be tungsten or whatever, right? And so if a government can't arbitrarily debase the currency, then that means that there's some sort of governing law outside of the apparatus that creates the legal framework that we operate in that's going to regulate them. So it's rules without rulers, which is a really monumentally big deal. You know, we trust people, and that's like the best we could do is trust people. But you create this honeypot, and the sociopath who doesn't care ends up corrupting that apparatus and getting into positions of power to serve their self-interest. And without the ability to meddle in the money supply, without the ability to debase the holders of a currency, then that means that a government has to become fiscally responsible. If the United States government wants to fund transgender studies in Bangladesh, and the people who are paying taxes aren't into that, then the government just prints dollars to fund that. Or if they want to bomb brown people all over the world or whatever, they just print dollars to do that.
Or fund wars and violence.
Totally.
And scale, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
It all comes back to the money. It comes back to every listener here. How many times a day does money influence your decisions? Well, everything. From the moment you get up to the moment you go to sleep, money influences everything. But it's the whole world runs on this, like wars, all the political issues. And it creeps into our lives in so many ways.
And so if the government can't arbitrarily debase the currency, then it has to become fiscally responsible. And then what happens is that the governmental apparatus becomes beholden to the preferences of its citizens. Because if the wealth is not confiscatable, and when they're printing dollars, they're confiscating the economic energy of the holders of dollars. They can confiscate your real estate. They can confiscate your taxes, your equities. They could effectively take anything that you own except for Bitcoin. So there's this idea that...
they can't take it. They can't make it.
They can't take it. They can't debase it. They can't make their own. So that's a governing function. It's money... Let's see. I think money is superordinate to law. And if you can merge the monetary technology that we're using with a form of law like Bitcoin has, where it's like limited in supply and nobody can co-opt it or control it, you have that governing force without having to trust on an individual or a group of individuals. The same force or the same thing that's in some of us, I guess I would say it's in all of us where we have a breaking point, but some people are sociopathic. They're willing to lie, cheat, and steal. Those people have had the ability to corrupt and co-opt and take over marketplaces, governments, etc. Without them being able to control the money, they can't do that anymore. And so this idea that we're struggling because of the bifurcation of our society, housing's becoming unaffordable, vote harder, vote for the politician who's going to give you more free stuff. We're voting for more of what has caused the problem. And that is, and it's very hard to wrap your mind around. But and that's another thing Jeff Booth says. There is no they, it's just us. The world is comprised of people who are trying to serve their self-interests. And some people are willing to do bad things. And I think that's also why we kind of feel that nihilistic, hopeless feeling at times, where if we're honest, good people, we're like, oh, I feel like the world is just unfair and like the rules are tilted against me. Well, because they kind of are. And so now you have this monetary protocol that is the ultimate form of law that no group of individuals can corrupt. And the thing that makes that work is the same thing that made the world so fucked before Bitcoin. It's people are going to first serve their self-interest. And so that force is going to drive people into the Bitcoin network because it is the path of least resistance to get the most. Get rid of all this physical stuff, get rid of all these derivatives, all these equities, all these other monetary instruments, and get the Bitcoin. That's how you get the most. And the act of doing so is going to bring down the value of all of these other things that we've monetized to their utility value. It's going to create the world of where you have scarcity in money, you create abundance in everything else. And you don't have to trust in some new political regime to make that happen. There is this form of law that they have to adhere to. It's in some sense, it's like Bitcoin is forcing cooperation. You know, there's this incentive to violence with physical stuff. You say, like in the Sailor series, Michael Saylor talked a bit about this. You go into a Venetian port. You're on a ship, however many hundreds of years ago, you land in the port and they say, hey, you're going to pay us 50% to use our port. You say, that sounds like a little bit too much. I don't think that's a good deal. Well, they just kill you and they get 100% of it. Right. So the incentive is to violence. And actually, it's pretty incredible the world that we live in. If you think about it from that terms, we actually default to being, to consensual trade most often. But you have that incentive with the Bitcoin, because if it's so easy to custody the Bitcoin in a way where no one else can get it from you unless you willingly give it up. That means that you need to offer up a deal that someone wants who has Bitcoin. Otherwise, you're not going to get the Bitcoin. So it's forcing cooperation. It's forcing consensual trade. It's incentivizing peace and agreement. and decentivizing violence. If you pull into that port, Venetian port, let's say it's in the future, we got spaceships, whatever it is, and all your surplus is in Bitcoin, and they say, hey, I want to tax you, and you say, nah, I don't think that's good. They kill you, they get nothing. So then the incentive actually would be to figure out some sort of a fair exchange. So yeah, all of that stuff is quite deep, pretty big deal. It's the inversion of almost everything and how our world has worked and pertains to incentives.
Eric, I can see why you're getting on more and more podcasts. Your voice is really valued in this space, and we appreciate you taking time and sharing with such passion. And all I want to say to the listeners listening, I got most of what you said because I've been around this space for a long time. But if you didn't, don't feel bad. Don't feel stupid. Just understand we all start our Bitcoin journey at a different place. What I can say is if there's a feeling in you right now as you hear what Eric's just said of like, oh my God, this feels right to me, follow that. And you'll find as you go more towards that Bitcoin world, you'll meet more and more people that are very deep thinkers like Eric that, you know, have thought about these really important aspects of life, liberty, labor, honest money, honest exchange. You said something there that every time governments are printing money, they're stealing from you. They're confiscating your wealth. Jack Mullers has a lot of interesting thoughts and beautiful articulation around these ideas as well. So guys, I hope today's interview with Eric has just pushed you forward that little bit. Eric, just over the last few days, we've seen for the first time in a while, Bitcoin starting to clearly bifurcate from the market as US Treasury yields are starting to go up. Uncertainty is creeping in, and we're now seeing the Bitcoin price elevate as a result of that, which is super encouraging just at the time that we're recording this. Long may that continue. My hunch is that it will. And it's been an exciting, three or four days at this very volatile time in the market. We're starting to see a rush towards Bitcoin again, which is exciting. Eric, any last thoughts you wanted to leave the listener with? Just think about the guy or the girl that's out there that's just, trying to make sense of it, is frustrated with working harder, seeing less for it, but can't really wrap their arms around it, their heads around it at the moment. What would be your message to that person right now?
So I got into Bitcoin in late 2017. It's basically become my obsession. I think about it nonstop every day. I feel so blessed to have the privilege to be able to talk about Bitcoin with people like you. And I've traveled over the world and gone to conferences and met a bunch of other Bitcoiners. And that's a really big deal. And you could say I'm much more in the know than I was when I was just living my quiet little cannabis farming life. I kind of had this idea that, let's say, like Adam Back and Jeff Booth and Robert Breedlove and Michael Saylor and whatever, that they kind of had access to information that maybe I didn't have access to. And I was wrong about that. We're publicly all trying to grapple with what this new discovery, because Bitcoin's more of a discovery than it is an invention or a technology. It's an invention. It's a grouping of other things together to create a protocol. Like I said, it's a protocol stack built on top of the internet. We're all trying to figure out what this thing means. And I think a few things happen, very generally speaking. I've experienced this when I'm talking to people about Bitcoin and I'm trying to share the things that I've learned with them. There's like multiple layers of cognitive dissonance. And there's like a lot of indoctrination that has to be let go of for you to understand this stuff. You know, we're taught this Keynesian lie, this MMT, this modern monetary trash, which is nebulous. It's ambiguous. It's hard to wrap your mind around. It doesn't make sense because it's actually just mathematically wrong. It's this like crazy bullshit story to justify having a government that could effectively steal from you to fund whatever it thinks is okay. So we don't actually have capitalism. This is something else I wanted to say earlier. People are like, oh, it's late stage capitalism. We need to tax the rich people. No, it's late stage central banking is what's happening. It's late. Yeah. If you have an economy and you have a central authority that controls the money supply, money is half of every transaction. It's the lifeblood of the economy. If the money is being debased, the money system is toxic. The blood that is operating, like you could think about the economy as a body, it can't store energy. So it's toxic. It's like Jeff Booth says this, like we have a society built today on a dishonest ledger. You can't have an honest society. So you need an honest ledger. You need an honest monetary technology. And so as I talk with people who don't understand Bitcoin and I'm trying to share, you know, what's happening, there's a cognitive dissonance that takes place. There's also this like mistrust, this idea that this sounds hyperbolic. It's too good to be true. And I think that part of that is predicated upon historically things that seemed to be too good to be true were, and people who just believed whatever got led to the slaughter. So we're like the descendants of people who were quick to question things that sounded too good to be true. So I don't ever judge people who are like, I don't know, I dismiss that. But after spending all the time that I've spent obsessing about Bitcoin, I can say that if I had no Bitcoin today, if I had no other assets, what I would be doing is I'd be working my ass off, whether it's a $10 an hour job, $100 an hour, it doesn't make a difference. And I'd be plowing into Bitcoin because it seems like some people think, oh, well, you like Bitcoin because you got it in 2017 or 2013 or 2020 or whatever your number is. I missed out on this opportunity. You people sound crazy. You talking all these certainties. And it just seems like, you guys are, you know, it's hyperbolic. You're all excited because you're fucking rich or killing the game or whatever. And I think what they're failing to understand is that we're speaking in probabilities, and that the conviction comes from understanding that probabilistically speaking, Bitcoin's convertibility into any other good or service that the marketplace can produce for as long as it exists will increase at a faster rate than any other thing's convertibility into any good or service the marketplace can produce. Simply because we're making less Bitcoin than we're making more of everything else. So Bitcoin will appreciate, and this sounds fucking crazy, but it'll appreciate at a faster rate than everything else forever, as long as it exists, simply because we're making more of everything else than we're making more Bitcoin. So you could measure the value of houses and shoes or cars and chicken dinners or whatever it is. You can basically measure the value of anything like that. So anything's convertibility into anything else is the way I would think about things. And if we're increasing the supply of dollars, we're increasing the supply of gold, like the gold bugs love gold because it's stock to flow. It was the hardest asset pre-Bitcoin. And then the halving that we had last year, Bitcoin became the hardest asset on planet Earth. And every 4 years, it becomes harder and harder until finally we hit 21 million Bitcoin, and that's all there ever be. So Bitcoin will appreciate at a faster rate than everything else forever. So it doesn't matter when you buy the Bitcoin. You didn't miss out on the upside from Bitcoin. You may miss out on part of the what I call the great demonetization, but it will still be the proverbial fastest horse. And so I really want to just emphasize that much. Like, you know, the Bitcoiners who are here in Bitcoin, we're not all just crazy and happy about Bitcoin because we bought it early. We're crazy and happy about Bitcoin because you have this inviolable, invisible monetary instrument that the world is going to reorder itself around. And as that happens, you're liberating the people who are impoverished, who are struggling the most, from the shackles of scarcity that they're experiencing. You're punishing the dishonest market participants. You're rewarding the honest ones. You're rewarding productivity. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on, but that's the big one. That, and then also, if you're measuring the value of your portfolio in terms of dollars, consider the fact that your portfolio might be going up in value, or your dollars are going down in value. Either way, that gap is increasing, and it's not the dollars going up in value. Most cases, if you have a 10% debasement rate in a currency, it means you have a 10% hurdle rate. If you're portfolio isn't increasing at more than 10%, you're not getting wealthier. Yeah. So that's like, those are some big points there that I think most people don't understand. It's counterintuitive, but yeah.
It's counterintuitive. It takes time. You've got to, the first step is understanding that you've been living in a system that you don't understand. And it just seems normal for so long that when you first discover Bitcoin, it's like landing on another planet where people have three heads, and it takes a minute to understand and adjust. And yeah. It's very easy to just go back to this. It's very easy to say all these Bitcoin people are wrong. And all these Bitcoin people are stupid, and all these Bitcoin people are hyperbolic. It's much harder to do the work. And as Michael Saylor said, I've never met an intelligent person who spent 100 hours or even 1,000 hours truly studying Bitcoin and then not bought Bitcoin at the end of it. But it's just so much easier to say it's just all bullshit. And, you know, it's an IQ test, and you'll get Bitcoin at the price you deserve eventually. So, be very interesting to see how that plays out. Eric, thank you so much for your time today, mate. I really appreciate it. I hope to see you in Bitcoin Nashville. I assume you'll be there. Sorry, in Vegas. I assume you'll probably be there.
I'm not sure if I'm going yet. I've gone back and forth on that one. But, yeah, I do look forward to meeting you someday for sure. Yeah,
I'm sure we'll cross paths. Thank you so much. We appreciate you. And where can people follow you? Where's the best place to hear more from you?
I'm on X, Eric V Stacks. You can get find me there.
Cool.
Yes.
Eric, thank you so much. We appreciate you, brother, and thank you for sharing the passion and the wisdom.
Yeah, man, it's been an honor. I appreciate you too. Thank you.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.